President Trump's 12-day swing through Asia is now in China. Along the way, he's delivering speeches, attending regional summits, and meeting with dozens of world leaders. President Trump gave North Korea a stern warning during his remarks before South Korea's National Assembly in Seoul yesterday. He devoted a big chunk of his address to the human rights abuses that Kim Jong-un and his relatives have committed in North Korea. Words like twisted, sinister, and tyrant, to name a few. We'll be unpacking the speeches and the expectations of the Asia tour this hour with Andrew Yeo. He's an associate professor of politics at the Catholic University of America and a fellow at the Institute of Policy Research and Catholic Studies. He's the author of Activists, Alliances, and Anti-U.S. Base Protests. He's co-editor of Living in an Age of Mistrust and North Korean Human Rights Activists and Discourse. His areas of expertise include international relations theory, East Asian regionalism, Korean politics, and North Korea. His recent piece, where we found him in the Washington Post, is titled Four Reasons Trump's Asia Trip is So Important. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what would you say be the primary objective of President Trump's Asian tour?
Right. I think the main thing for Trump being in Asia is first showing up for the region, but second, to reassure our allies, particularly Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, that the U.S. still cares very much about this region, that the U.S. is engaged, and given ongoing threats, especially from North Korea, that the U.S. is there to be on their side. So really, that's an important message. The questions are really whether he unveils any sort of larger strategy for the United States and Asia.
And we'll get to North Korea in a moment. But why is it important for President Trump to show up, as you say, in Asia?
Right. So there's always this fear about U.S. commitment, the credibility of U.S. commitment for U.S. allies. It's one thing to say that if there's any sort of attack against South Korea or if China were to start some kind of conflict with Japan or Taiwan, that the U.S. would actually come in with troops to defend these allies. And for there's always questions of whether the U.S. will really pull through. So there's that aspect. And the second is just with Asia. I mean, one thing that's been argued by a lot of policymakers is that for Asians, showing up actually matters a lot to these meetings. And it's gotten to the point where, and the example is always with the Bush administration in the mid-2000s, where President Bush wouldn't show up to some of these multilateral meetings. He'd send his deputies or the Secretary of State rather than show up himself. And some Asians felt a bit slighted. It was like saying, oh, well, our region isn't as important, where other world leaders are coming to these multilateral meetings. The United States president is not. And so from the Obama administration, the U.S. has really shifted its tactical approach to Asia. This was known as the strategic rebalance to Asia or the pivot to Asia. And so that's where we're at today. And I think, again, it's for the U.S. president, for President Trump to travel all the way to Asia is significant for policymakers in the Asia region.
Some news stories have used the word grueling or marathon to describe this five-country, 12-day trip. How big of an undertaking is this for a president?
Well, you have to imagine. I mean, it's Asia. It's the time difference is 13, 14 hours from Washington, and it's a very demanding trip. And it's not just the president. He has his entire entourage. He has the media coming with him. He has lots of scheduled meetings. There's a lot of talking points that he has to go through. So even if it were just a 3 or 4 day trip, that would be difficult. But the fact that it's almost 2 weeks, I mean, this is probably, I mean, if you ask Trump, he'll tell you it's the longest trip that any president has ever taken. I don't know if it's the longest, but certainly it's one of the longest trips out there. Even for President Obama, you know, when I was speaking with his NSC director for Asia, they said that he wouldn't take any more than 4 stops. And Trump is going on 5. So it is quite taxing. And there was even some fear of whether Trump would make it to the end or not. You know, a few weeks ago, Trump mentioned that he would not attend the East Asia Summit in Manila. This was at the very end of his trip. And so it looked like it would be an 11-day trip. But a few days before leaving for Asia, he backtracked and he said that he would attend. So again, this is a very grueling a trip. There are a lot of important meetings, and I'm still not, it's still out there whether he makes it to the end or not. I mean, Trump is over 70 years old, and again, he talks about his stamina. He's very proud about that, but again, it is a long trip. There might be pressure back at home if, you know, we had the shootings in Texas that was at the beginning of the trip, but, you know, if say that there was some kind of incident or domestic crisis at home on day 9 or day 10, there might be some pressure for the president to come back early.
Well, let's look at where the president is now in Beijing. He said yesterday, though, in Seoul, that he made this comment at a state dinner that had a lot of people wondering that it would be an exciting day today for many reasons that people will find out. He didn't elaborate. What is going on in Beijing?
So Trump is, he likes to build up expectations. You know, he's a great showman. You know, he was a reality star TV, and, you know, the Chinese are going to put out probably, there hasn't been a state dinner like this, or a state plan for another world leader like they're going to give Trump. I mean, the way that the Chinese had referred to it is it would be the red carpet plus sort of thing. So again, they're going to really try to wow him. They're going to put everything that they have in front of him for two reasons. One is to just really treat him very well. You know, Trump, you know, very much appreciates it when world leaders make him front and center. When he becomes center stage, he's the guest of honor. But in some ways, you have to wonder if it's also a tactic to maybe intimidate the U.S. president a little bit, to show, you know, how grand and how wonderful China is. So of course, this is going to be a grand party for the Chinese, and I think that's Trump might be referring to that. Of course, you also have China and the United States are the two largest, the most influential players on the world stage, not just Asia. And so whenever you have the president of the United States and the president of China getting together, it is a big deal. So I think Trump is really trying to play that up. I wouldn't say that there's any
big reveal
message that the right a reveal about. I mean, he did mention that when he's in Vietnam, there's going to be a speech when he's in Vietnam a few days later, and so the expectation was that he might unveil some sort of strategy there. But you never know, though, with Trump. He likes to keep us guessing, and he likes to do the unexpected. So we'll see. But I don't imagine that there's going to be anything on the policy front that we might be surprised about.
If you're just joining us, we're with Andrew Yeo. He's an associate professor of politics at the Catholic University of America and a fellow at the Institute of Policy Research and Catholic Studies. He was the author of a recent Washington Post article titled Four Reasons Trump's Asia Trip is So Important. It ran Saturday when the president left for this 12-day trip to Asia with quite a bit of diplomacy going on. And you can join in this conversation, by the way, 800-642-1234. What do you make of President Trump's East Asia visit? Is America's approach to the region on the right or wrong track? Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Andrew, the president is scheduled a meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping today, expected to discuss trade issues with China, and also to rectify the huge barriers that American companies have to surmount to gain access to the Chinese market. That's how the White House officially put it. What can we read into that?
Right. So Trump has really been pushing Asian countries hard about trade imbalances. And it's clear that he's quite different from the previous Obama administration, how he addresses economic issues and especially trade. And of course, in the past, other presidential candidates had called China a currency manipulator, and it's no different from Trump. I think one thing Trump wants to see is that there's a lot of exports that come into the U.S., the Trump administration is going to push China pretty hard in trying to allow American exports of manufactured goods agriculture, these sort of things into China, because it is a fairly large trade imbalance. Speaking with some policymakers in Washington, you know, there's an argument that Trump hasn't really been pushing China as hard as he was during his campaign, and some wonder if that has to do with the relationship that he's struck up with Xi Jinping. You remember when Xi Jinping was visiting
in
Trump
April.
In Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah. And yes. We're going to press the pause button there. We're going to flesh that out in just a moment here with Andrew Yeo, helping us understand the diplomatic agenda on President Trump's Asia tour in the midst of it in Beijing today. Your thoughts on it, 800-642-1234. How should the U.S. deal with North Korea's nuclear weapons program? We'll return after these news headlines. President Trump is in Beijing today, roughly 5 days or so into his five-country swing through Asia. He's pressuring China's President Xi Jinping to put more pressure on North Korea to stop its nuclear ambitions. President Trump has some chemistry with China's president, as we've been talking about. He first hosted Xi Jinping at his Mar-a-Lago estate last spring. In the past, he has said he is counting on China to do the right thing with North Korea, but China has stopped short of targeting the North Korean regime with unilateral sanctions that could threaten Pyongyang. We're delving into the agenda, the messages, the diplomacy of the president's trip through Asia with Andrew Yeo as our guide. He's an associate professor of politics at the Catholic University of America and a fellow at the Institute of Policy Research and Catholic Studies. He's author of Activists, Alliances, and Anti-U.S.-Based Protests. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. What would you like the president to do about trade with Asian nations? 800-642-1234. Andrew, in the last few hours, it was revealed that there were, in a ceremony, $9 billion of business agreements rolled out. We don't know, I guess, what is inside these agreements, but 19 agreements, $9 billion worth of business with China. So what does it look like with the trade talks and what could happen in business with China?
Right. So here with Trump's visit, and I mentioned that he has this entourage that's with him, he has several executives that followed him on this trip. And it's not just for China. There's also business deals that might be had, you know, when he was in Japan and also especially in Vietnam and the Philippines. So it's not just about trade. It's also about bring up these deals. He has Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross joining him on this trip as well, too. The executives of Boeing, Goldman Sachs, Qualcomm, these are just some of the company and their executives that have followed him. So we are expecting some agreements to be made. And these are things that Trump can come back home and say, well, you know, this trip was successful because we've struck these deals and this is more investments. This is more U.S. investments into China and that we can get some return. But of course, this doesn't deal directly with the trade imbalance. And, you know, for the companies that are benefiting from these agreements, it's not helping some of the workers, you know, in the manufacturing sector in the Rust Belt or in the Midwest who have perhaps lost jobs. Because of trade with China, it's not really improving that sector. The base, and these are the base supporters for Trump. So, on one hand, trade isn't being addressed head on here, and of course, Trump is going to talk about the trade imbalance. But rather than focus on just trade, it's actually easier to set up these business agreements and make a claim for victory by saying that we have all these investments.
And perhaps it's more second nature to the president to do it that way than to have these tough negotiations, tougher discussions, conversations about trade.
Right, because the assumption is for these agreements that China is also, you know, there's something in it for China as well, too. And I just remember back in when, you know, Shinzo Abe or Xi Jinping came to the United States, they had a strategy in mind of saying, well, what are some things that we can offer Trump? The U.S., the Trump administration was really big on infrastructure investment in the United States, you know, constructing bridges, repairing roads. So a lot of this is with infrastructure. And there was some thought that maybe the Japanese or the Chinese might invest, and that would create jobs here in the United States. So much in the same way, Trump is going to China and to other parts of Asia, thinking that he might be able to offer these investments, but at the same time say that this is a chalk up for a win for the U.S. So you're right, though. It's I think it is in some ways an easier thing to do, and it can skirt around some of the more difficult issues, the thorny issues that arise with the great trade imbalance with China. It's about $350 billion. Last year it was about $350 billion.
Another reason you gave for why Trump's East Asia trip is a big deal is to forge a stronger consensus on North Korea's nuclear threat. And he had been talking very tough words toward Pyongyang and even pledged to meet any North Korean hostility with fire and fury. But then he said this yesterday in Seoul.
We have many things happening that we hope, in fact, I'll go a step further. We hope to God we never have to use. With that being said, I really believe that it makes sense for North Korea to come to the table and to make a deal that's good for the people of North Korea and the people of the world.
Is this perhaps a change in rhetoric by the president, or what do you think he's doing here?
Well, certainly it's a shift from what he had said about a month ago when he chastised Secretary of State Tillerson for talking about diplomacy and an engagement with North Korea. And he basically said, that's not going to happen. And of course, we had the fire and fury rhetoric. But you have to remember, the Trump administration's official policy towards North Korea is maximum pressure and engagement. And of course, the focus has been mostly on pressure. So I'd say it's maybe 90% pressure and 10% engagement. But the administration has left some room for engagement and dialogue. And this was the part of the trip, you know, in South Korea that many Asia experts were a bit nervous about, because South Korea, the president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, himself is someone who ran on a platform for approaching North Korea through a more conciliatory stance. And even though he's been supportive of the United States policies and has been supporting sanctions, I think in his heart of hearts, he really would like to engage North Korea. And so there was nervousness about Trump, you know, going back to the fire and fury rhetoric of really escalating the tensions. And as the clip indicated, you know, he kind of took a step back. I mean, he still mentioned that, you know, he threatened North Korea by saying we might do things that, you know, that they would never want us to do. And of course, that's a veiled threat about the possibility of using military force. But he did leave open that door for engagement and diplomacy. And this is a big, in terms of making this speech in Seoul, South Korea, I'm sure this went a long way to strengthen the relationship between the United States and South Korea. It's as if the United States in some ways was giving into consideration what perhaps the South Korean president's perspective is on North Korea. So he hasn't walked back from pressure. He hasn't walked back from the possibility of military options. But yes, he did lay out this the option of engagement.
And he's really calling for China and other countries to pull together to confront North Korea, which he described as a sinister regime that starved and terrorized its people. He called the regime a tragic failed experiment in the laboratory of history. So some pretty high-flying rhetoric here.
Yes. So,
and he was making that speech like 120 miles from Pyongyang.
Correct. So, of course, whenever you talk about North Korean human rights, you're basically bashing the North Korean regime. And this, I mean, the human rights activists who work on North Korea, and you know, I keep in touch with them. I have a book that's coming, a co-edited book next year that's coming out on North Korean human rights. But they were ecstatic that the Trump administration went to length to talk about North Korean human rights abuses. Of course, the focus has always been on North Korea's nuclear program, but they do have a terrible record of human rights. And this was something that the president wanted to highlight. And of course, this fits the image. This, if you're trying to isolate North Korea and demonstrate to the international community why this is a regime that that there shouldn't be any support, that they need to be isolated, that they should be coerced. They're basically, they need to go if you're even going to try to promote something like regime change. You've made a good case for it. It's not just the nuclear weapons, but it's also the human rights abuses. And yeah, he wasn't restraining there, and he kind of went all out on the human rights angle.
How have we seen the response of the crowds, the people, to these speeches at these summits, at these photo ops? How have people in South Korea, in Japan, received President Trump?
Well, in Japan, he was received very well. He's treated as, I mean, it was like having a celebrity come and visit. And his rapport, his relationship with the prime minister, Shinzo Abe, is it's probably one of the best relationships out there among world leaders. And one thing you notice about Asian leaders is that they've approached the Trump administration with much more pragmatism. They haven't been out there, criticizing him, but they know that he's a deal maker and he's transactional. So they've approached it the same way. But in terms of the public, Shinzo Abe just recently won elections with a large majority. And so his popularity is as high as could be for any Japanese prime minister. And so, Trump was received quite well. In South Korea, it was a little bit different. There were scores of protests that took place before Trump's visit over the weekend. These were organized by trade unions. And there was some nervousness here about Koreans. So South Korean, the public itself is split on the Trump administration and in particular Trump administration's policy to North Korea. So in the editorials and conservative newspapers, of course, they chastised anti-US protest, anti-US rhetoric, saying that this is a terrible time to, given the sensitivities of the security situation, you don't want to alienate President Trump, and it would look bad in comparison to Japan, where he had this warm reception. So in South Korea, there were these protests, but the South Korean government itself was very, in some ways, there's applications to try to protest in front of the Blue House. That's the equivalent of the White House, the South Korean president's home before the dinner. But those permits were denied. So they tried to keep protesters away from Trump's site. But it does show that even in Asia, there's some mixed feelings about Trump. I think in China, so I'll just be really quick on China, that the media has been actually excited about this visit. And as I had mentioned earlier, it's the red carpet plus, or the state dinner plus that Trump is getting. It's like the royal treatment. And so the media is closely following this. And I think the public is probably going to be enthralled as well, too. Like in Japan, Xi Jinping is coming out of the 19th Party Congress, who had really consolidated his leadership. I mean, basically, his words, Xi Jinping thought that's actually being included into the Constitution. So here's, popularity means a different thing in a communist country like China.
Sure.
Right. But he does have this image of being a very powerful leader, and you have the president of the United States coming. And so I think there's a lot of anticipation and excitement among Chinese for this trip.
And
I think that,
Let's bring in a call now, Anne in Menominee. In Monona. Sorry, Anne, who would like to address China? Anne, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I think that no American president since Clinton supported NAFTA and all these free trade agreements have been instituted. That benefit these multinational, originally American companies, I think most of all, no American president really is going to have any power equal to the Chinese government's, because we owe China billions and billions and billions of dollars. And as a debtor, I think that, and China knows this, and they have been very patient, and, you know, they have not done anything drastic so far, but they know that the power imbalance is just inherent in what's been going on. And as for, you know, the trade imbalance, well, American companies have essentially bribed American politicians to let them go to other countries to have their goods made as cheaply as possible. It's not that the Chinese don't make beautiful clothes, they always have, but this is American-inspired, and the Chinese, if I were a Chinese politician, I would be quite happy at this point, because I don't think, you know, I mean, Trump's inflammatory, but I don't think any American president has much say-so in these negotiations.
Let's get Andrew to respond, with China having the upper hand here. Andrew?
I would agree. I mean, if just by the laws of economics and comparative advantage, it would be very hard for this trade imbalance to even out. I think what the U.S. wants to see is they want to see this the trade gap narrowed. I think that's a possibility, and that would be a win. But for the time being, because of, you know, the laws of comparative advantage, China does have the upper hand on this, but it's up to the, a lot of it is for domestic consumption back at home, though, because there are certain groups within the U.S. that feel that they lose out from trade with China. And so every election cycle, you always hear rhetoric about China being unfair in its trade practices. But all things being equal, it's it is China being China does have the upper hand. It's really about the U.S. Government being able to kind of manage the optics of this trade imbalance.
Anne, thanks so much for that call. Andrew, China could be putting more pressure on North Korea's infrastructure. That China supplies much of North Korea's energy. It's North Korea's crude oil flows in from a pipeline from China. But then on the flip side, China has taken some steps. It's agreed to sever banking ties and joint venture companies with North Korea, limit the export of diesel fuel. It shut down North Korea's coal imports earlier this year. Is this enough in terms of sanctions? What does America want?
Right. So the Trump administration, this has been the biggest pressure point for the United States, that they've really been pushing China to go after North Korea in terms of sanctions. About the statistics vary, but if 80 to 90% of trade of energy for North Korea is coming from China, then China has a lot of economic leverage against North Korea. Now, I want to make a distinction between political leverage, political influence, and economic influence. China doesn't have that much political influence these days over North Korea, but on the economic front, it does. It and does. They have gone along to some extent. They have cut coal supplies. I think the last few months, coal shipments have been close to zero. At least officially, that's what's been acknowledged. They've been tightening sanctions. There are some businesses that have been censured who have been skirting the sanctions. So China has been on board. The question is, have they been doing enough? And that's what the Trump administration wants to know and press.
And we're going to probe that in just a little bit here. We're with Andrew Yeo, an associate professor of politics at the Catholic University of America and a fellow at the Institute of Policy Research and Catholic Studies. You can join in this conversation about the Asia Tour. 800-642-1234. Is America's approach to the region on the right track or not? How should the U.S. deal with North Korea's nuclear weapons program? Join in. We'll be back after this news update. American and Chinese companies signed more than a dozen deals worth $9 billion as President Trump arrived in China today on his five-country Asia tour. The talks in Beijing are probably going to be focused on trade and tensions over North Korea's nuclear program. We've seen no details, though, of the 19 business agreements signed at a ceremony in Beijing. To help us understand this Asia trip, we reached out to Andrew Yeo. He's an associate professor of politics at the Catholic University of America and a fellow at the Institute of Policy Research and Catholic Studies. He's the author of Activists, Alliances, and Anti-U.S.-Based Protests. He's co-editor of Living in an Age of Mistrust and North Korean Human Rights Activists and Discourse. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Is America's approach to Asia on the right track? What questions do you have about trade with China and Asian nations? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Andrew, back to your Washington Post piece, you wrote that another reason this trip by the president is so important is to get clarification on where U.S. foreign policy is headed. What message have you been he's been sending, especially toward Asia in the 10 months he has been president?
Right. As I mentioned earlier, one thing that the U.S. wants to demonstrate is U.S. commitment, reassurance to its alliances. And as we know, the Trump administration goes back and forth in what he says. So he'll criticize allies like Japan and South Korea for free riding, for not carrying their burden share. But then he'll also, those in his administration will then walk back that line and say, no, that we, we support our allies, and there's nothing greater than the U.S.-Japan or the U.S.-Korea alliance. And I think because of these mixed signals, what Asian leaders want to see, especially our allies, is whether the Trump administration is committed or not. So they want to see clarification. Beyond clarification, they want to know if Trump actually has a strategy in place that's maybe different from the strategic rebalance that the Obama administration had. And so far, I actually don't think, I think at the level of strategy, with the exception of economic strategy, the Trump administration withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a free trade deal with 12 nations. Other than that aspect, I actually feel that things are not that much different from the previous administration in terms of how the U.S. is approaching Asia overall.
And your last reason why this overseas trip is critical for America is the chance to reinforce ties with Asia. Are we doing that? Do you think this is making a difference?
Well, it's definitely showing that the Trump administration does, as I mentioned before, that they do care about the region. One thing we noticed is with the East Asia Summit, Trump, I also mentioned that he decided not to put that on his itinerary, but then he included it. And again, I think this was to demonstrate that it's important for the U.S. to show up, not only bilateral meetings, but multilateral meetings. And I would want to add one more thing, because we've been seeing this language about the Indo-Pacific region, and we hadn't really heard this that much, but Trump has been pushing this forward quite a bit in the past few days. And I have two possible explanations for this. One is, I've mentioned that Trump hasn't done, his policies themselves are not, they don't deviate too much from the previous administration. And as we know, Trump wants to do things that are different from Obama. He wants to basically undo a lot of Obama's policies. So it's walking away from, hearing the pivot or hearing the strategic rebalance. And he wants some language, phrases of his own that can connect with Asia policy. So there's that. But then the second bit also has to do with the importance that India plays for the Trump administration. And also, I don't know if it's a challenge, but it's acknowledgement that China also has been expanding west with initiatives like the Belt and Road, investments in South Asia into Central Asia. And so China is looking west. And I think the U.S. doesn't want, and the Trump administration recognizes this and also wants to make sure that, well, it's not just East Asia, we're also going to be looking west too. And for the U.S., that would be this in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean region where these two areas meet.
Let's bring in another call now, Bernie in Elkhorn. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. Kate, you asked the question about what policy should be with respect to North Korea. And I would put the thought out there that the policy should be to leave them alone. The reason they want a nuclear program is they don't want to end up like Iraq or Libya, And I know Americans generally aren't well informed, but we are the empire of the day, and we are the one with the military across the globe that has killed millions of people for no good reason over many decades. So I would say, you know, I don't like nuclear tests. They put radiation in the atmosphere. They're not good. But the best thing we could do, they want nuclear weapons as a deterrent. Best thing we could do is Trump should promise not to attack North Korea first, get the missile systems out of South Korea, and allow those two Koreas to work things out and stop the rhetoric, as he did at his UN speech, threatening to blow North Korea off the map.
Andrew, go ahead.
Sure. So that's, I mean, it's a really insightful comment, and it leaves this question of, is it better for us to just give North Korea the silent treatment, leave them alone, and maybe the problem may resolve itself? But I think the danger with that is that you're sending a mixed signal, or you're sending a signal to the international community that it's okay to proliferate. And two, there's a major assumption there that that North Korea would actually halt or would cease moving forward with its program if the U.S. were to leave it alone. I think the U.S. has, I mean, it's difficult with the Trump administration and its fire and fury rhetoric coming out, but the U.S. Has talked about not using, I mean, that they wouldn't be the first to make the strike. I mean, it goes back and forth, but I think the danger here is that if you do nothing, it's just going to allow North Korea to move further forward. It's clear that they don't want to give up their nuclear weapons. And the longer we wait, I think the less incentives North Korea has to give up its nuclear program. But it sends signals to other regimes, other governments who may want to explore nuclear weapons. It also
It sets a precedent.
Right, and especially for the region and Asia going nuclear. So if the U.S. decides to do nothing, then Japan may think, well, if the U.S. isn't going to take a hard position on this, well, then maybe we should consider, and they have. There's been some discussion. I don't think they will, but there's discussion about whether Japan should have a nuclear deterrent. And, of course, that would make China nervous. The South Koreans would be nervous. And there's a danger of creating a nuclear arms race within Asia.
Almost a domino effect, it feels like. Yeah.
Right. So there'd be this a nuclear domino effect. So I think that's one of the reasons why the U.S. comes out. And at least even if the U.S. can't tangibly do anything to stop North Korea's progress, the assumption is maybe having these sanctions may slow down a North Korea, buy some more time. But it is sending a clear signal that this is the type of international behavior that is really, it can really cause a major crisis.
Andrew, in the few minutes we have left, I want to go to some of the lighter moments. The president had a little fun with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Monday when talking about Japan's booming economy. Let's listen.
The Japanese people are thriving. Your cities are vibrant. And you've built one of the world's most powerful economies. I don't know if it's as good as ours. I think not. Okay? And we're going to try and keep it that way. But you'll be second.
Okay, it's hard not to laugh when we hear things like that in a very fraught, diplomatic, tense environment. But he has moments of levity here, has he not?
Yeah, so he, you know, in typical Trump fashion, you know, this is his banter. And of course, he talks about America being first and no one's going to beat us. So it's about showing a bit of USA pride out there, but he does it in a joking fashion. I think it creates a few laughs in Japan. And he did something similar in South Korea where he talked about South Korea, you know, women's golf is all the rage in South Korea. Mm-hmm. And I think like the top four players in the world are from South Korea. And so he mentioned that the new world number one had recently played, won a major championship, and it was at a Trump golf course. And so he brings these things out. And of course, here back in the United States, you might roll your eyes. You know, Trump has such a large ego. Can he just restrain himself from making these comments? He probably can't, but, you know, it causes a few laughs, and it may actually help break up the ice, or at least in South Korea, you know, they recognize that Trump, you know, that he Yeah, he's observant and he wants to, you know, he wants to say nice things about South Korea. And it's the same thing with Japan. He was trying to say some nice things about Japan and Japan's economy, but of course, making sure that nothing goes, it doesn't overshadow Trump or the United States.
Well, in the minute or so we have left with you, what are you watching for in the remainder of President Trump's visit to Asia?
We're still expecting a big speech in Da Nang when he travels to Vietnam. And I want to see if there's more specifics about U.S. policy to Asia. You know, I said that he's done a good job in reassuring our allies. But is there a new policy that, and are there concrete policy plans that are in place that the Trump administration wants to unveil? So I'll be at least looking to see if that takes place.
And in the Philippines?
Right. So in the Philippines, and of course, he has a meeting with Duterte, who's in some ways a reflection of Trump himself, with being a rhetoric and a bit of being a populist leader. There's been some disappointment that Trump hasn't talked a bit more about of human rights. You know, he brought up human rights in North Korea, but with Duterte, you know, he's going on this campaign to basically kill drug dealers, and it's kind of gone off the walls. And there's some anticipation of whether Trump will bring this up or not with Duterte.
Well, Andrew, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me here.
Andrew Yeo is an associate professor of politics at the Catholic University of America. He is a fellow at the Institute of Policy Research and Catholic Studies. His recent piece in the Washington Post is titled Four Reasons Trump's Asia Trip is So Important. It ran Saturday as President Trump embarked on his Asia tour. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Nyasia Ellison. We had technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.